Terrific, thank you. And our final presentation.
Thanks very much. I applaud you all for being here. My colleagues where I work suggested that perhaps the best thing I could do would be to offer free drinks for both the people who stayed, but there are a lot more.
Just let it load.
Okay. My presentation isn't about a program, it's more about information for direction for programs. I've been a member of the health administration section for a long time, but also oral health. And to some extent, this paper is a result of a lot of my experiences with the oral health section, and specifically how to increase utilization of dentists and dentistry. The slide for my affiliation is at the end for some reason. Health Economics Group is a private corporation. I'm an owner and I'm the president of it, and that's the affiliation. It's generally accepted that all of us should get regular dental checkups. The reasons include, of course, that dental disease is progressive. That is, a relatively minor problem, such as a small cavity that may be treated by the placement of a one surface filling, if neglected, may well develop into a situation in which a root canal is required, followed by placement of a crown. Fillings are relatively inexpensive, and the treatment lasts less than an hour. A root canal, followed by a temporary crown, followed by placement of a custom-made crown, is a treatment regimen that is both lengthy and, frankly, unpleasant. Another reason for visiting a dentist regularly is that dental professionals are trained to identify conditions or markers that signal various disease states. Increasingly, dentists are able to spot trouble in parts of the body beyond the oral cavity. Dental health is part of overall health in terms of prevention, diagnosis, and treatment. Even though we all should see a dentist annually, not all of us do so. In fact, dental utilization, defined as at least one visit to a dentist in a given year, is much less than 100%. So much less that one of the goals enumerated in Healthy People 2010 is to increase utilization nationally such that 56% of adults see a dentist annually. Much has been written about the reasons for this relatively low utilization, about the various barriers to the seeking of dental care. These barriers include the cost of care and the availability or proximity of dentists and dental facilities. Removing these two barriers, increasing access to care, it is said, will allow dental utilization to increase substantially. If only the cost of dental care was low and the number of dentists could be raised. Other barriers that have been identified include psychological, educational, and or cultural factors. To put dental utilization by adults into perspective, perhaps a perspective not ordinarily envisioned, other data dealing not with issues of cost and proximity, but with barriers of a behavioral nature were examined. My company, Health Economics Group, is a third-party administrator located in Rochester, New York, although I'm very glad to hear about Stamford because my wife and I just moved to Stamford, Connecticut in July, and I'm commuting. Stamford, you're doing wonderful things. We've been managing self-insured dental benefit plans for 30 years. We have decades of detailed longitudinal data covering tens of thousands of individuals, many of whom have been covered for 20 years or more. While most of the people covered by plans we manage live in central and western New York, we pay dental claims in about 30 states throughout the country and beyond. Dental utilization data for this study were extracted from our claim system. Utilization by adults 18 to 64 enrolled in the plans we manage were examined for each of five calendar years in four-year increments, 1988, 1992, 1996, 2000, and 2004. We did not look at utilization among adults ages 65 and older because, frankly, most employers don't cover people beyond the normal retirement age, so we have no data for that. The number of adults covered by one of the many dental plans we managed for each of the years examined is relatively large, more than 30,000. All of the dental plans cover diagnostic and preventive services at 100% UCR. Now, you probably all have dental plans, and you probably haven't read your dental plan booklet like most people, and you don't read it until you're going to go to the dentist. But UCR means that the plan will pay whatever the dentist bills up to about the 90th percentile of charges that prevail in a given area. But for these plans, for these people, virtually all of the costs of dental exams were covered at 100%. And because recall or preventive visits for diagnostic and preventive services were covered nearly or completely in full, and because dental proximity was not an issue, because all of the adults covered were either themselves or their spouses working in full-time jobs, almost all paying quite a bit more than minimum wage, it may be concluded that issues regarding access were not significant for the adults in this analysis. Table 2 shows, in addition to the numbers covered, the number who had at least one dental visit during the year. This table also shows dental utilization expressed as a decimal fraction. Utilization was at a high in 1988, with 63% of the enrolled adults between 18 and 64 years of age going to a dentist during the year, and it was lowest in 2004. And it's clear that the utilization's going down. We don't know why, and we're checking into that. But with respect to the individuals analyzed for this study, it can be stated that somewhat more than 40% of adults ages 18 to 64 do not seek dental treatment in a given year, even if that treatment is free. There's an interesting and surprisingly similar parallel between voting patterns and the pattern of adults visiting dentists. The 5 1-year periods examined in the study were selected because they were presidential election years in the United States. Political scientists, politicians, and others decry the fact that voter turnout is far less than 100% election after election. The frustration expressed by political scientists is similar to that expressed by public health professionals who are trying to get people to go to the dentist or, frankly, to get any other aspect of healthcare. For purposes of this analysis, information concerning the numbers and fraction of the adult population ages 18 to 64 was extracted from U.S. Census data. Table 4 shows the fraction of citizens ages 18 to 64 who voted in each of the 5 presidential elections. 1992, incidentally, was the first election in which Bill Clinton ran. It is seen that, like those who do not seek dental care, approximately 40% of adults in the 18 to 64 age range do not vote. Table 5 shows both the fractions of adults who visited a dentist and the fraction of citizens of comparable ages who voted. The 5 period means are quite close, 59% and 61%. And by the way, if for anybody who wants it, I've got a copy of the paper with the graphs and so forth in it. At the end, you can have it. I think this is pretty interesting. It was just absolutely stunning to me. You can see that dental visits and voting patterns are pretty darn much the same. They're not identical, but they're close. Should be mentioned that the dental utilization data were not age adjusted to the U.S. citizen population, and we'll be doing that pretty soon. Analysis of dental and voting utilization, if you want to call it that, by age, yields interesting patterns. Table 6 shows dental plan enrollment and utilization in 2004, broken down by age cohort. It can be seen that utilization is lower among older adults than for those who are younger. Utilization drops continuously as age increases. For the same age cohorts, population size and fractions of U.S. citizens who voted in the 2004 presidential election are shown in Table 7. Unlike going to the dentist, voting tends to increase with increasing age. Table 8 presents both the fractions with a dental visit and the fractions who voted. And look at this one. It's clear that for adults 18 to 64, dental utilization and voter turnout are similar, but the slopes of the respected plots are opposite. Again, aggregate data plotted for five presidential election years shows that these two behaviors, visiting a dentist and voting, are quite close, but so what? Well, is there any useful significance to the fact that adult dental utilization and voting patterns are nearly congruent, or is this just another interesting statistical artifact? Are there any useful implications here for health administrators and those of us concerned with public health? I would stop now if the answer were no. The answer, I think, is yes. All of the adults covered by dental plans my firm manages are themselves and or their respective spouses working full-time, working for employers that sponsor and pay for their dental benefit plans. For these plans, employees are required to pay at most a minor fraction of the premiums. For the people in this study who were covered by dental plans, the cost of obtaining regular dental care was very small. Furthermore, there are enough dentists near where they live and or work to meet current as well as increased demand for care. Access is not a problem. Nor realistically is the lack of awareness that it is good to see a dentist regularly an issue. Certainly the vast majority of working adults who are covered by an employer's dental benefit plan know that they should avail themselves of dental care. At the very least, they've been told time and time again that this is important. Knowledge of appropriate behavior or lack of this knowledge is not a problem. Yet close to 40% of adults with access to care do not get dental care in a given year, which raises an obvious question, why not? Adult citizens in the United States know very well that they should vote in all relevant elections, of course, but most definitely in quadrennial presidential elections. Except for minimal costs to get to and from polling places, for the most part, there are no economic barriers to voting. Proximity is not a barrier either, because there are polling places in all neighborhoods close to where people live, and all of us receive instructions as to where our polling places are and when they'll be open. Yet, close to 40% of adults with access to the voting process do not vote in a given presidential election, which raises an obvious question, why not? Much has been written and said concerning the reason citizens in this country do not vote. As far as I know, lack of access to a polling place is not seen as a significant barrier keeping 40% of adults from voting. In this study, the cost and proximity barriers were at most minimal, yet it was found that even with good access to care, dental utilization by adults is, from a public health perspective, discouragingly low. It would appear that reasons other than access play an important part in keeping adults from receiving dental care on a regular basis. These behavioral barriers can be quantified at a first approximation by looking at the fraction of people who do not visit a dentist, even when the cost and proximity of a dentist are not issues. Could it be that access to care has been overstated as a barrier to the 40% or more adults who do not seek dental care in a given year? Data developed in this study suggest that this may well be the case. If true, and if we want to increase the fraction of the population who receive dental treatment on a regular basis, we might be better off focusing our efforts on such non-access areas as education and motivation instead of working to build more dental offices or educating more dentists. And this is why I'm presenting this at the health administration section and not in the oral health section. Health administrators sometimes are at odds with various provider groups as to why the provider groups are not being seen more frequently. In truth, we probably should do both. We should educate and we should make sure our facilities are adequate. However, during bad economic times such as these, it may well be more cost-effective to take a multidisciplinary approach to addressing the issues of dental utilization. Health educators, sociologists, and perhaps behavioral economists should be asked to join with dentists and health administrators in an effort to develop viable economical solutions for this very real public health problem. Paying people to vote or fining them if they don't are not viable options when it comes to increasing voter turnout, nor are they good options for increasing dental utilization, certainly not in this country. Charismatic candidates can and do play a role in voter utilization, more commonly called turnout. Before long, we may have sufficient data to determine the impact, if any, of charisma in the 2008 presidential election in about a week. In closing, I do not want to be unkind, but it seems to me that charismatic dentist is somewhat of an oxymoron. Therefore, to increase dental turnout, public health professionals in a variety of disciplines are going to have to work together to determine how to get people to do what they know they should do but don't. When they have the solution, perhaps they can market it to politicians and political scientists to increase the voting turnout. But as an alternative, perhaps someone will develop an analog to absentee voting when it comes to visiting a dentist. But until that happens, we all have work to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And thanks for your book.
Yeah.
That was very interesting and very timely. I don't think I personally have ever thought about the connection between the healthcare that one gets and its implication to political views, voting, democracy, and it's very important. Thank you. We have about 20 minutes, 15 minutes. I'd like it to open the floor up for questions for our speakers. Do you want to come up here? Any questions? Yes, sir.
I'm a guest. I'm not a public health person, but this is for Mr. Cooper. How likely do you think it is that part of the reason people don't go see dentists or they avoid dentists is because they suspect dentists are intentionally damaging people's teeth? I hear anecdotal stories. I've even had it myself. I reported it.
That's a good question.
Go ahead.
I certainly can't answer that quantitatively. Anecdotally, I share your the observation. I've been dealing with the statistics on dental care for, turns out, about 30 years. I used to be on the faculty of the Eastman Dental Center in Rochester, New York, a postdoc dental school where I taught in a course dealing with statistics and things like this. Back then, I happened to mention to a bunch of dentists that dentistry is something you can't give away to a third of the people, at least. A lot of people are afraid. A lot of people just don't want to do it. A lot of it's cultural. A lot of it's somewhat educational, but the health educators in the room know that education is really important. We all should do things we don't do, which is, I think, the only parallel with voting. I mean, one of the interesting things is do people who don't vote go to the dentist? I don't know, and who cares? But it's just that it's behavioral, and there might be a whole bunch of reasons.
But you heard stories similar to what I told you?
I haven't heard that as reasons for people not going. I've heard it anecdotally, people saying that, but not that they, I mean, people don't go to the dentist because it hurts. Do dentists intentionally hurt people? I would suggest that very few do, unless they're very mean. I'm not an apologist for dentists by a long shot. I went last week and the guy was great. But the guy before that, and it was a guy, it was terrible, which is why I switched. But I think people don't go to healthcare for a lot of reasons. I was on the Board of Health in the county in New York where I lived, and we found that when there was there was an immunization clinic for kids, and there was also a rabies vaccine program for pets. A higher percentage of people took their dogs and cats in than took their kids in to get immunized. In large part, one of the things tying into what you were saying is that a lot of young mothers don't want to expose their kids to the pain of a needle. So a lot of these things are intertwined.
Thank you. I was way into my adulthood, I used to think that if you're a professional, you're competent. And way into my adulthood, I discovered that just because you're professional and have a degree doesn't mean that you're skilled. And it's unfortunate, just like there are some doctors that are unskilled, it's unfortunate that there are some dentists that are unskilled. But that's my, you know, my personal anecdote here. As somebody who lost her first tooth, I had no choice. It died on me. Any other questions? Yes. Can you speak up?
I'm a question for Olga Brown and Andrew. I'm not sure you might have said this in your presentation. How many graduates have come to ELTA air conditioning training facilities?
The question was how many graduates have come through the Parent Leadership Training Institute. In Stamford, we have a total of 207, and if you include the parent supporting educational excellence, that's another 84. And certainly if you include the children, that's over 400. In the state altogether, there are over 2,000 graduates. So there's a pool of parents who are really involved with children's policy and working with all of the systems that impact children.
Next question. Well, I'm glad that the presentations were thorough and clear. Do any of the panelists, after hearing all the presentations and thinking about your work and perhaps interconnections with the others, are there any final remarks you'd like to make?
Yeah. I'd just like to say that the programs that exist as programs that were described have a real bearing on answering some of the issues that I raised as to why people don't seek health care. It's not necessarily more facilities. It's not necessarily more providers, but it's encouraging people to take part of the facilities and the resources that are available. And I think that's really, some of us were talking earlier on, what's a unifying theme? I think that's one of the unifying themes. I think it's up to all of us to get people motivated to take advantage of programs that already exist, and we don't necessarily have to spend new money on new things. We just get people to do things better.
Any of the others? Well, terrific. Thank you very much. It was a very interesting panel. I think that we learn what people on the ground floor are doing every day to improve the lives of people in their community. And I commend all of you for your hard work, and thank you very much. For those of you who are interested in joining the Health Administration section, celebrate its 100th anniversary. Be sure to stop by the Health Administration booth and get a ticket. And thank you very much.